This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 5 years, $500 billion, the deaths of more than 4,000 Americans and many times more Iraqis later, we are still feeling a kind of shock and awe. Though perhaps not the kind intended by the Pentagon when it rained bombs on Baghdad on March 19, 2003. Then we did feel that kind of awe, especially we in the media, like Wolf Blitzer.
I think it's fair to say in the 30 years that I've been covering these kinds of stories, General Shepard, I've never seen anything like this of this kind of magnitude on live television, maybe not even on not live television.
This week, the crew here at OTM combed through our voluminous coverage of the Iraq War and found that our archive runneth over with examples of media manipulation, credulity, and courage. In the end, we managed to assemble a show of highlights to illuminate where we've been and perhaps where we ought to go. At least we ought to pay attention, and that's getting harder. TV news watcher Andrew Tyndall says that in the last 15 weeks of 2007, the networks collectively spent just 4 minutes per week on the war.
But let's start at the beginning, shock and awe. When the bombs fell, the media were, to put it crudely, stoked, and they showed it with escalating displays of patriotism. Cable news had the martial music and the flag pins, and the news anchors who saw the Iraqi street through rose-colored glasses when American soldiers trudged in.
Basra has been the focus of a lot of attention, and there were concerns that a humanitarian disaster could be provoked. But, John, look at this, little children and the soldiers giving them candy.
Yeah.
Greg Mitchell is the editor of Editor and Publisher and author of So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. He says that in the war's early days, none of the mainstream news outlets could resist getting on board with the story of the war.
And besides the graphics, the headlines, and the flags that were jumping out of you from the screen, you also had a tremendous imbalance in terms of the voices that were allowed to speak on the air. You had no really anti-war voices or even people raising questions about the war.
On the subject of boosterism, some of the uncritical embrace of the mission pretty quickly leaked from the red, white, and blue cable news sets to the embedded reporters. We're going to have more on the embed program coming up next. But for the moment, just listen to this piece of tape from CNN's Walter Rogers early in the war.
So we pulled back for that. And as I say, when we were pulling back, we could see the area we had fought through 2.5 days ago. And when we pulled back, there were lots of...
Greg,
right.
We...
Well, not only we, but we fought. I mean, that's the shocking thing about it. I'm not sure that Walter picked up a gun there. I hope not. But certainly the impression was that they were, let's say, deeply embedded with the troops. Fortunately, they did not meet so much resistance and that the war phase did not last all that long. But that, of course, as you know, led to a misleading impression of what would follow.
If it's true that the media were slow to pick up on the realities of the situation in Iraq, it's equally true that at the same time, they were under intense pressure from the administration and from the political right to find more good news and stop reporting so much bad news. We were hearing a lot about turning points at various stages of the war. Tell me about the reporting on so-called turning points.
Well, one of the first one was the death of Saddam's sons, which was supposed to crush the spirit of the insurgency. And then we had the capture of Saddam himself, which was supposed to be a true turning point when we took Fallujah pretty much by destroying it and supposedly had wiped out the main viper's nest in Iraq. That didn't quite happen. Then we had the death of Zarqawi, whose face, dead head, was put on the front pages all over the country. That was supposed to crush the spirit of al-Qaeda. That didn't happen. There has been this continual trumpeting of turning points. And here we are 5 years later, and we have more troops in Iraq right now than we had 3 or 4 years ago.
I'm speaking to you on Wednesday. In this morning's New York Times, on one of the inside pages of the front section, I saw a photograph of an Iraqi who had died on the operating table as a result of wounds inflicted in a car bombing. It was a very grisly picture, and I did a kind of a double take because I haven't seen a lot of grisly images coming out of this war, and I wonder why that is.
Well, the loss of images from this war has really been one of the more shocking things. We have seen almost no graphic photos of American dead or American injured. We've seen Iraqi dead. The photos exist, but they're not published. Now, there are reasons for that. For one thing is the Pentagon has said that it will not allow or discourage the media from using images of dead or wounded Americans until family members have been notified. Well, this is a process that takes 2 or 3 days at least, and by that time they're no longer news photos, so they lose their value as news. The other factor, which many people are aware of, is the ban on showing the coffins or caskets of soldiers coming back from Iraq. We do see images from funerals. So it's not completely antiseptic, but given the carnage, it is kind of staggering to reflect on the almost total lack of really graphic images of Americans suffering.
I remember so vividly the first day that the New York Times listed the dead on an inside page when it had ceased to be page one news. It was quite early into the war. Now coverage on cable television, at least, is quite low. A year ago, it was 24% dedicated to the Iraq War, and now it is just, Greg, 1%. What has happened?
Well, for one thing, news organizations, which are under financial pressure, have withdrawn a large number of people from Iraq. Secondly, of course, we had the political campaign starting. It's much sexier. I think media feel that there's a fatigue factor among the public. But people who think that's a dead issue are really fooling themselves. Just imagine if there was a debate tomorrow night between John McCain and either Clinton or Obama. Can you imagine what that debate would be like on the issue of Iraq?
What you've described and what you describe in your book is a media that as an institution was insufficiently skeptical, was insufficiently critical when there was evidence of bad faith by the administration, and now is paying insufficient attention to a war that continues to rage. After 5 years, have we learned nothing?
We have seen a tremendous number of very tough stories from very brave reporters in Iraq that I would never discount. And I think there has been kind of a sense among some in the media of a certain amount of shame, a certain amount of guilt about what they did before the war. And I think the reporters have tried to do a tougher job since then. But I have to say that in looking at the fifth anniversary coverage, one thing that's been missing in the hundreds of articles and all the hours of TV coverage is reflection on the media in the run-up to the war. So I think that perhaps individual reporters tried much harder to get it right. But I'm not sure at the top whether there is the sense of this really one of the greatest black eyes in the history of journalism.
Well, Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Mitchell is editor of Editor and Publisher magazine and author of So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq.
The Pentagon still believes that critical reporting of Vietnam sapped the nation's will to fight, so ever since it's kept reporters far from the theater of war. But the Defense Department was unhappy that its successes in the first Gulf War went unchronicled, so it sought a solution to the problem of bad coverage versus no coverage and found it in the newly minted Embed program. Hundreds of reporters would be assigned to military units. If at any point they chose to leave them, they would lose their places to the next in line. They could write what they wish if it didn't compromise operational security, but they would be tethered to the troops responsible for their safety. The military brass was delighted, including Major General Victor Renouart.
In terms of bringing the media onto the battlefield, I think this has been a really an historic event.
And Brigadier General Vince Brooks.
We have embedded media so that the truth does come out.
And General Tommy Franks.
I'm a fan of it. I think it was a very good thing to do.
We spoke to Chris Kramer, then head of CNN International, after it aired a live firefight between U.S. Marines and Iraqi snipers near Qasr.
I thought as I drove home that night that, you know, no longer would many children around the world have to ask their fathers what they did in the war, because in one way they could actually witness it on television. And that's when I realized that television news had made a paradigm shift.
For the 6 weeks of what came to be called major combat operations in Iraq, NPR's John Burnett was embedded with the headquarters battalion of the 1st Marine Division, slated to lead the invasion. We spoke to him shortly before the war began after a military briefing in Kuwait.
We had a meeting here in Kuwait City with some of the public affairs people with the military last weekend, and some of the Q&As they had emailed to us said that you will all have an escort while you're in the theater of operations. And whoa, what's this? I mean, any reporter who gets an escort is immediately suspicious that this is a minder. This is someone who's going to be the eyes and ears of the Pentagon. And so I raised that with the Marine public affairs guy who will sort of be in charge of us. And he said, let me tell you about escorts. An escort is somebody I pay $75 a night for and take to a hotel room. I don't care for escorts. Ha, ha, ha. The press laughed it up. And then he followed up and said, what you're going to have is a Marine buddy. And so all the laughing stopped. And we all looked at each other and, what is a Marine buddy? And he said, this Marine buddy is going to be assigned to each one of you, and he's going to keep you safe, and he's going to explain how we war fight, and he's going to help you get interviews, and you'll be glad you have him. We're very curious what our Marine buddies are going to be like.
Are you concerned that you'll come to love your military colleagues, your comrades, so much that you'll be less inclined to report the warts?
You really get to the heart of what my greater concern is. I'm not as worried about how the Pentagon wants to control our message. I'm more concerned about human nature and what's going to happen to me when we get in a combat situation and we are with these men and women who are fighting and there's incoming and they may have to save my life. How much am I going to identify with them? One of the things that a veteran war correspondent told us when we trained at Fort Benning to do this is the greatest threat out there is to remember you're not one of them.
We also wondered what would happen to John, so we called him every week. And in the next segment, you'll hear what he told us about reporting the war through a soda straw. What came to be called major combat operations in Iraq began with shock and awe on March 19th and ended with the president's announcement of mission accomplished on May 1st, 2003. There were two ways to cover this war, as a so-called unilateral, unprotected and on the periphery of the fighting, or as an embed. NPR's John Burnett was embedded with the 1st Marine Division, and we called him every week. On March 14th, he had just been embedded. I remember last week you were a little skeptical about the presence of an escort, not an escort, of a Marine buddy to help you along your news-gathering tasks. Has your buddy presented himself?
Yes. In fact, the U.S. Marine Corps has assigned me my Marine buddy. He's a very sweet young corporal, looks like he's about 19 years old. His name is Quana, and he is anything but a censor or a minder or anything that we would associate with trying to spin the content of what I'm doing. If anything, he's here to help me get my gas mask on when we have chem bio alerts. He's here to show me around the camp. And so far, I'm really encouraged that the military is following through with what they said they were going to do. I mean, I've only actually been out here in the desert with the troops for 3 days now. But in those 3 days, we've met the commanding general of the 1st Marine Division. We've met the chief of staff. We've met the assistant commander. They've all said, what can we do to help you do your job? Which is just not something you really expect from the Department of Defense. So I'm encouraged so far.
Are there any concerns that remain as you look ahead to covering a possible war?
Well, in a sense, I mean, this is all a dress rehearsal, Brooke. Nothing really matters until the war starts.
Week 2, the coalition forces invade Iraq. Burnett returns to Kuwait after a brief incursion by his Marine battalion over the border. It's obvious you really like these guys and they're protecting you. Do you think that some judgment other than news judgment is going into what you choose to report?
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel any constraints to say what I want to say. And if the time comes to rake them over the coals for an operation gone awry, that's exactly what I'll do. What's interesting is that I think when you come over here and when you embed with this group and you, in a sense, become sort of part of the project of the invasion and pacification of a country, you cease to hear the dissonant voices against that project. We're not going to have as much access to the civilian centers where there are going to be collateral damage and civilian casualties. And so we're going to depend on our colleagues tremendously to come behind us and to do that important reporting to find out how this invasion is influencing, you know, the people of Iraq and what they think about it. So, you know, once again, we see what we see and we don't see what we don't see in this operation.
Week 3. Burnett is inside Iraq, somewhere between the Euphrates River and Baghdad.
We are clearly being used by the Pentagon, and in some cases for propaganda purposes. And let me give you an example. We talked with the head of the intelligence section a week or so ago, and he was telling us all about the fearsome firepower that the Marines were going to bring to bear in this battle, and how, you know, they were going to overwhelm their opponents with air power and ground forces, and really send a message to Baghdad that it's pointless to fight. And I commented, it sounds to me like you're using the journalist as your mouthpiece for this. And he said, you know, well, yes, we are. At this point, John Kiffner with the New York Times, who's with us, just kind of leans back in his chair and says, I think I'm getting queasy. So there's that sort of covert use of us. And then also, it's kind of an ongoing commercial for the U.S. Marine Corps. But also understand that they're taking a chance in letting the journalists in here. There are a lot of, you know, old guard Marine officers who don't think we belong here. So it's a very sensitive thing that the Marines are doing within their own culture as well. I want to stress that.
Week 4. Burnett is with an artillery unit moving just behind the front line, 20 miles south of Baghdad.
One of the unnatural things about the embedding process is we don't get a sense of how Iraqis are reacting to this really enormous invasion. And I see them on the streets, and I just wish I could get a translator and jump down there. This is what I usually do when I cover a war zone, is to kind of mix with the local population. And we can't jump back and forth and talk to town folk and cover the military at the same time. It's either or. And as far as I know, there's only one reporter who's able to do that, Dexter Filkins with the New York Times. He's a lone wolf. He's a unilateral. He's traveling with one of the fighting regiments. He has been able to unofficially embed himself, and he's stopping and talking to Iraqis, you know, how people in the towns are reacting to the Americans. He's getting great stuff, and I'm envious.
Week 5, only 3 weeks after the start of the war, Burnett decides to cut his military ties and report on his own from inside Baghdad.
Basically, the embed process is kind of in tatters. I have gone wherever I can get a helicopter ride, wherever I can get a Humvee ride. I learned that the best thing to do is to use your own initiative and just go where I want to go and tell the public affairs folks later.
So as you look back on this, what, now about 6 weeks, how would you assess the whole embed experience?
I'm not sure this is a workable arrangement, the whole embed process. I think it's an unnatural way to practice journalism. But one of the good things to come out of this is that the whole experience has helped, I think, bridge the gap of distrust between the military and the media, which is going to yield better defense reporting in the future because they're going to be more open with the media, and I think we'll understand them better.
Week 6, our last conversation. Burnett is now back in Kuwait, packing for home.
Remember when we talked several weeks ago and I said very matter-of-factly, well, this will work if the unilaterals come up behind us and do the other half of the reporting and get into the villages and talk to people and give our audience the balance that they expect. Well, that really didn't happen. The importance of going back to the places that the Marines charged through and find out what were behind the smiling faces and the importance of finding out where the bombs hit was really driven home to me when I did a story this last week on my way out of Baghdad. Just by happenstance, really, I stopped into a small village, Al-Taniya, which had been bombed by the U.S. Air Force, 30 men, women, and children were killed in their beds as they slept. As we reported on All Things Considered on Friday, the U.S. Air Force says that they were precision-guided bombs aimed at tanks and track vehicles, and they all struck their targets, and they really had no explanation for what I saw and what the villagers told me. Now, embeds couldn't see that.
If you look back on the history of war reporting, you can see that there have been two ways that militaries have dealt with the press. One was to exclude them, and the other was to co-opt them. The embed experiment was an exercise in at least attempted co-optation, I think. Do you agree?
Well, sure, it was. And I think to an extent it worked. You know, many of us were cheerleaders during the 4 weeks in spite of ourselves, because that's the story we had access to. I've been thinking about what my 11-year-old son got for Christmas recently. He got a G.I. Joe that was an Ernie Pyle doll. It's the first toy journalist that I'm aware of. It even comes with a little plastic Smith Corona typewriter. And I kind of marveled that, you know, gosh, war correspondent is hero. And I think about the embed process and, you know, and living with the troops, and certainly there will be no wars again, you know, like World War II, when there was a unanimity of the righteousness of the cause. You know, I wonder if there are going to be any Ernie Pyles again.
Burnett is right to wonder. Ernie Pyle was the bard of America's fighting forces. His stories were soldiers' stories of heroism without ambivalence. It's hard to imagine another war where reporting just one side will be enough.
The Iraq hostilities began 5 years ago, but the government's propaganda war for a conflicted, compliant, and sometimes culpable media began more than a year earlier in February 2002.
Saddam Hussein needs to understand I'm serious about defending our country. I think one of the worst things that could happen in the world is terrorist organizations mating up with nations which have had a bad history, and nations which develop weapons of mass destruction.
Almost from the moment the World Trade Center towers fell, President Bush sought a connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, a connection that there was no evidence of then, nor any since, yet which he has repeatedly invoked for 6.5 years to frame the invasion of a neutered and isolated police state as a defense of America's borders. To support the case came the next gambit, leaking phony intelligence to key reporters, notably the New York Times' Judith Miller, in order that the independent media be seen as validating administration claims about Saddam's nuclear weaponry ambitions. Here's Vice President Dick Cheney talking on Meet the Press about aluminum tubes.
There's a story in the New York Times this morning. I want to attribute to the Times. I don't want to talk about, obviously, specific intelligence sources.
And finally, the war drumbeat at its loudest. Secretary of State Colin Powell's notorious briefing to the United Nations, which found in an innocuous trailer telltale evidence of weapons of mass destruction. And much of the media lapped it up.
Flanked by CIA Director George Tenet, Powell presented a multimedia show of sorts using previously classified satellite photos and intercepted phone recordings, all intended to show how Saddam Hussein is keeping banned weapons hidden from inspectors.
But in terms of managing public opinion, this was mere prologue. The past 5 years have seen a perverse symbiosis, the yin of government deception joined with the yang of media credulousness. And it began quickly. A few weeks into the war came iconic images of ecstatic Iraqis toppling Saddam Hussein's statue in a city square. The earliest footage was strangely undramatic, a sparse crowd more milling around than euphoric, and Marine vehicles visible in the frame. No problem. That soon vanished for a close-up view of the same scene, focusing on the most raucous elements, and played and replayed endlessly in cable news.
Smashing it to pieces. They're paving their fists in the air. They're chanting death to Saddam.
The tight shot, of course, also obscured the role of U.S. forces, a role that, as Los Angeles Times reporter David Sacchino told us more than a year later, was even greater than first understood.
Now, read from a long interview by the team leader of a PSYOPs team assigned to the Marines who reached Firdaus Square where the statue was. He writes, "The Marine Corps colonel in the area saw the Saddam statue as a target of opportunity and decided that the statue must come down." And later on, he adds, they get a U.S. Marine recovery vehicle to come in, and they pack the back of it with some very exciting and shouting Iraqi kids, and then the Marine vehicle pulls the statue down, but from the way the TV cameras were situated, the way it showed, it looked like there were crowds and crowds of cheering Iraqis pulling the statue down.
Almost simultaneous with the statue incident came the heroic rescue of Private Jessica Lynch, the soldier liberated from a Baghdad hospital by an extraction team of her comrades. According to the Washington Post and hundreds of other papers that ran the story, the team stormed the ward to snatch Lynch from her captors, whereupon she and her rescuers bravely shot their way to freedom.
The story that everybody is talking about, though, today is this daring rescue of Jesse Lynch. I mean, this is the stuff of which movies are made, really.
Yes, you know, we try to get our POWs out of Vietnam. We're not successful. We try to get our hostages out of Iran. We're not successful. We now have this wonderful force, the JSOC, it's called. It has Delta Force SEAL people, Air Force people, and they know how to get in there in deception with a lot of night activity and grab somebody. It's a wonderful story.
Shortly thereafter, the British press began to report that the heroic details had been fabricated. As one hospital employee told the BBC,
"We were surprised at that time why they do this. There is no military, no Iraqi soldier in the hospital."
Yes, the Pentagon's feel-good story was exposed as a lie. But as Brooke observed in her interview with documentarian Sandy Smith, the truth emerged at the wrong moment to generate much outrage.
Now, partly it's because the war is over. But I wonder whether you think there may be another reason why there's no great rush to correct the record.
What Jessica Lynch played to was the overwhelming feeling of relief in America that we were doing okay.
Wait. Did she say the war is over in May 2003? Well, yeah, but believe me, she had that on good authority.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
The president flew in by fighter jet, tailhooking to the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln and declaring mission accomplished. The only problem was the mission wasn't accomplished. 3 weeks later, I asked New York Times White House correspondent Elizabeth Boumiller whether we should be concerned about a government better at spectacle than at truth, one that conceals harsh and complex reality beneath martial and vainglorious imagery along Leni Riefenstahl lines.
I don't perhaps think it's as dangerous as you think it is. I just think it's American politics. To be a successful politician, you have to be good on television. We've known that for many decades now.
No, see, I wouldn't say dangerous. I would just say vaguely creepy. At taxpayer expense.
Well, I'm not going to say that. I don't know. What is the alternative? If you're the president, you know, and you're going to be on television, they got to shine a light on you because otherwise you're not going to be seen. Where would you draw the line?
I don't know. But I do know it has long since been crossed by an administration that spun Corporal Pat Tillman's friendly fire death in Afghanistan as Silver Star heroism, that barred the media from photographing the arrival of coffins at Dover Air Force Base, lest the human toll of the war be too forcefully rendered, that promoted a candid and unscripted Q&A between the president and U.S. soldiers in Iraq, only to deliver this.
Can you give us a sense for the reception of the people there in Tikrit toward coalition forces as well as the Iraqi units that they encounter?
Sir? In north central Iraq, voter registration is up 17%. That's 400,000 new voters in north central Iraq and 100,000 new voters in the al-Saladin province.
This time, though, thanks in part to some careless satellite transmission from the Pentagon, the press was on to the con and said so on the evening news. NBC's Andrea Mitchell.
The White House had said the exchange would be spontaneous, but there was something they did not expect you to see. The troops were coached on how to answer the commander-in-chief.
Oh, no, it's
this is Allison Barber. She works for the Pentagon.
Master Sergeant Lombardo, when you're talking about the president coming to see you in New York,
Take a little breath before that so you can actually be talking directly to him.
This was not 2003. It was October 2005. A chastened press corps had begun to express the skepticism and even indignation that it had suppressed or underplayed or was duped out of for the first half of the war. As for the administration, well, to stage fiction, you need willing suspension of disbelief, and that is long gone. On Wednesday, extolling his war achievements, the president once again invoked the name Al-Qaeda, 14 times, in fact, and once again, he claimed he was defending our shores.
Because we acted, the world is better and the United States of America is safer.
But nowadays, as someone once said, this will not stand. In the news coverage of the president's speech, any linkage between Iraq and 9/11 was delicately but conspicuously debunked. About 6.5 years too late, but better late than never.
Up next, the war's new voices, Al Jazeera, soldier bloggers, and Iraqi citizen journalists.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Our portrait of this war has not been painted solely by the usual complement of reporters, pundits, and politicians. A wide range of new voices has emerged to add context, detail, and dimension to the picture. Chief among these new voices, the hugely influential, in some quarters infamous, satellite news channel Al Jazeera.
Launched 12 years ago by the Emir of Qatar with the goal of being an independent voice in the region, Al Jazeera has at one time or other been booted out of most of the Middle Eastern nations it covers. The White House, too, condemns it as hateful propaganda, citing its repeated airings of Osama bin Laden tapes and continuous grisly footage of the war. Al Jazeera's offices were bombed by the U.S. military in Afghanistan in 2001 and in Baghdad in 2003. Brigadier General Vincent K. Brooks said that reporters were not targeted, but that the battlefield was, quote, a dangerous place.
And a hard place to win hearts and minds, but Al Jazeera has won them. As of 2007, its Arabic channel rivaled the BBC with roughly 40 to 50 million viewers worldwide. But hearts and minds are not so easily won here. After Al Jazeera's English-language website was hacked in 2003, I asked the site's managing editor, Joanne Tucker, how she justified what seemed to be a pattern of anti-American war coverage, civilian casualties dominating every headline.
It strikes me that Al Jazeera has a special responsibility to play it straight down the middle and not to reflect back the worldview of its audience.
But we're not just looking at ourselves and reflecting what we see in the mirror. If you honestly and intelligently reflect the opinions and the facts and the views of this part of the world, how can it be skewing the news any more than reflecting the West's views and opinions skews the news for Western watchers? I keep hearing about this holy grail of objectivity and neutrality. I certainly don't see it on American television. So, you know, how they can apply these standards to us all the time, I don't know. But we try and report probing taboos, crossing red lines as often as we can. Does this get us in hot water all the time? But I think this is a price worth paying.
That price climbs higher the closer you get to events on the ground. And that brings us to the amateur scribes, Iraqi citizens and American soldiers. The soldier blogs are direct descendants of letters from the battlefield, only now they're available to all in real time.
You know, I don't comment on Army policy. I try not to comment on politics.
We reached Colonel and blogger Michael Bautista in Kirkuk in 2005. He said he started his blog to chronicle his personal experience, but over time, he used it to convey what he believed was the real story of the war, not just car bombings and death, but mission and accomplishment.
I want to say to the American public that my brothers and sisters in arms that have died in this conflict have not died in vain. This is a just cause, and that it's a righteous endeavor. That's part of why I write. If I'm given an opportunity to say it, by God, I will.
What about your personal feelings? Do you ever, for instance, get afraid? And do you write about that fear?
I'm sure that my enemy probably reads my blog. One of the things that I need to make sure is that I don't tell him that I'm scared of him. I mean, hey, every day I go out into a foreign city where there are a number of people who don't want me there, and they possess explosives and guns, and of course there's fear every time you leave the wire, and even just walking around inside the wire. You cannot communicate that to your enemy, or else you will lose.
Soldier blogger Jason Hartley, who had spent 14 years in the National Guard, used his blog to explore the absurdities of life in wartime, and it cost him a promotion and a hefty fine.
You were accused at one point of conduct unbecoming a non-commissioned officer because you took a picture of yourself sitting on the can.
Yes.
You said that you think Army leadership can't grasp that it's possible for a soldier to be critical or satirical of the Army and still be pro-Army.
This bothers me a lot. My commander, he assumes that I don't like the Army. It's not the case. I love the Army, and my way of exalting it is like, here's some pretty absurd stuff we did today. It's what happened. Doesn't mean I love the Army any less. It's just something kind of funny we did.
Did you learn anything about yourself writing about yourself?
Yes. I didn't really intend to always write about duality, but that was always what I found was this common thread for the most part. An event would take place, and there would always be these incredibly opposing ideas. Even with things that I felt sometimes, the first time that I actually shot at someone with the intent to kill them, intellectually, I know this is morally repugnant. There's no more bigger than the murder of another human being. But that experience, that was the most exhilarating thing that I've ever experienced in my life, was making a concerted effort to kill someone. I have to admit this.
Friday, December 26, 2003, 1:07 a.m.
Blogs are personal.
Tonight, the Daily Thuds started a bit earlier. It was around 10, and NBC2 was showing Sleepless in Seattle. I'm a bit embarrassed to say this, but I am a sucker for a Meg Ryan movie. The only problem was the sound of the explosions was a bit too close.
That entry, read by someone on our staff, comes from the blog Where is Raid, written by the once mysterious Iraqi blogger Salam Pax.
It wasn't just the thud we got used to in the last 2 days, but a very deep rumble as well. It's the third night now. Can anyone please tell me what's going on?
In the spring of 2003, his blog disappeared for a few weeks, and people on several continents who hung on his idiosyncratic dispatches from Iraq were gripped with fear. Iraqi blogs offered a way out of the soda straw created by the embed system. They couldn't be fact-checked, but the people who wrote them were palpably real.
Wednesday, January 28th, 2004, 12:50 a.m., I've been tuning into the American Forces Network much more often than the radio we Iraqis are supposed to be listening to. They played Rage Against the Machine's Testify. Baghdad is burning. That cunning mantra of killing. I need you, my witness, to dress this up so bloodless, to numb me and purge me now of thoughts of blaming you. It is a bit scary to have a military radio that plays this song here in Baghdad.
Turns out, Salam Pax was the nom de plume of Salam al-Janabi, a fixer for an American reporter in Iraq. Once, Western reporters could travel freely, but now they increasingly rely on Iraqi bloggers to keep them up to speed and Iraqi fixers to bring the reporting to them. What follows is a story I reported in 2006 about Iraqis pulled into journalism by a trick of fate, caught up in the wave of correspondence pouring in from the West. George Packer, author of The Assassin's Gate, found the blog called Healing Iraq while covering Iraq for The New Yorker.
Well, the first time you go to his blog, it says something like, views of an Iraqi dentist. And then there's a quote, I believe, from Swift. So you're just thinking an Iraqi dentist whose epigraph on his blog is from Jonathan Swift, and who is writing these long, informed, historical accounts of what's going on in Iraq today. Who is this guy? Where did he learn all this? You know, why is he writing this? Is he real?
It is useless to attempt to reason a man out of what he was never reasoned into. That's the epigraph from Swift that sits atop Healing Iraq.
I thought he was maybe 50, not a guy in his mid to late 20s, because he seemed so reflective and sort of sad and slightly disdainful about the militias and about the violence and about Iraqi politicians and about American mistakes. But there was no hysteria and there was no rank partisanship. He somehow seemed to take the whole thing in and see it as the tragedy that it was and is.
I thought that in the early days of the war, the Western media was just pouring into Iraq and they were confused about everything and they were just missing a local perspective.
Ziad, he prefers to leave off his last name, writes Healing Iraq.
There were many misconceptions in the Western press, too many to count. So I just tried to do one at a time, and that I thought that would be my mission. I was probably one of the few people who actually supported the war, at least in my community in Baghdad. I wanted to convey that sense and that support.
Ziad is now studying journalism at the City University of New York, reporting on local stories in Brooklyn. On Monday, he posted this on Healing Iraq.
Another close friend of mine has been killed in Baghdad. We had lunch together in Baghdad just days before I left. I can't concentrate on anything anymore. I should not be here in New York, running around a stupid neighborhood asking people about their issues. I now officially regret supporting this war back in 2003. The guilt is too much for me to handle.
Do you feel like you've marooned yourself onto a desert island or something?
Yes, yeah, sometimes I have that feeling. I get depressed many times and think, what am I doing here? I mean, I should be back with my family. I mean, if they're in danger, at least I should be in danger with them. I can't be safe here while they're suffering over there. I'm also willing to learn. That's what I came here for. That's at least what I tell myself.
Ziad doesn't see himself as a newspaper or TV reporter. He doesn't want to work for a Western news agency. He's not even ready to renounce dentistry. But for now, he says he needs to reach out to the West his way.
Maybe my focus on online journalism is kind of my way out of this. not to be immersed too much in the risk and at the same time doing my best to get out the story. I mean, that's what I can do. I mean, I can't be like any of those brave Iraqi springers who went to Fallujah and embedded with insurgents. And I could never do that.
Ali Fadil does that, a doctor who ran afoul of Saddam's regime when he bought a color laser printer without permission. He fled and was practicing medicine in Yemen. When Baghdad fell, he returned.
To participate in building my country. And I thought, we have now a new Iraq, we'll have the best Iraq ever in the world. I have to be there from the beginning.
But in the Baghdad hospital where he worked, the equipment didn't work. The security was non-existent.
And worse than that, politics was coming into the hospitals, it was coming into the Minister of Health. You can see everything is being taken from you and like you're an alien in your country. At that time, I was approached by the media, by the Financial Times. I thought, okay, I couldn't do anything as a doctor. Probably I can do something as a journalist.
Did it ever occur to you before this point that this might be a profession you'd want to be in, journalism?
No, not at all. No, never.
In reporter speak, a fixer is a translator, navigator, and person finder for a journalist on unfamiliar ground. But in Iraq, where the streets are perilous, the fixer often is the unsung reporter who asks the questions and brings the answers back to his journalist boss. A great fixer can even save your life. One reporter described Ali Fadil as a rock star among fixers, smuggling one Western reporter under a blanket in a free fire zone, clearing the path for another who wanted to speak with some angry young man with guns. Now, Ali works as a freelancer because working with Western reporters is more likely to get you killed. But even alone, it's still likely. George Packer.
They're targeted by the Sunni insurgents. If they write bad things about the Shiite militias, they're targeted by them. They often run afoul of the American military at checkpoints or simply by being in Baghdad and being Iraqi. And now more and more, the Iraqi government is their main enemy because it's clamping down on them, it's throwing them in jail, it's beating them up, it's keeping them from the news.
Last month, Ali Fadil wrote a piece in the New York Times praising the efforts of the Coalition Provisional Authority to establish a free press in Iraq.
Ali wrote that it would be very ironic if the Americans, having sort of fathered this democratic process and created an independent Iraqi press, watched while it turned into yet another state-controlled press corps like in every neighboring country. I would say, though, that unlike the Iraqi police and army, the young Iraqi journalists I know are real professionals and are quickly achieving sort of international standards of excellence and are winning awards and are keeping the world informed and are getting killed for it.
So I put it to Ali, currently studying journalism at New York University. This is a really dangerous job. You have a wife and two kids. How come you want to do it?
I want to correct this. I have an angry wife and two kids. She's very angry about my job. She hates that I'm doing this job. The reason why I like journalism, the reason why I thought that the risk you take while doing a story is worth it, is because I saw Western journalists throwing themselves in these remote areas of Iraq. I've never dreamed of going to these areas, and I think it's too dangerous just to be there as a human being, but they just go for the sake of the story. I worship this thing in journalism, and that's the way how it goes, and I think that's the way I'm going to take it. It's my country at the end, and I have access to many places in Iraq Westerners don't have.
Unlike Ali, Ayub Nouri did not become a journalist by accident. Born in the Kurdish town of Halabja, notoriously gassed by Saddam, he was a teenager when he met his first Western journalists, a British TV crew, who hired him as a translator. He was already an experienced reporter at the age of 24 when Elizabeth Rubin, filing for the New Republic just before the war, hired him as a fixer for a trip to an Arab part of Kurdistan.
And the Kurds were telling us, don't go, you're going to be killed. And Ayub basically said to me, though he is a Kurd, he said, don't trust these guys. They've been looting every single Arab village and they don't want us to see it. And so we went to this village and, in fact, there was a fight going on between the Kurds and the Arabs of this village because the Kurds were trying to steal all the petrol at this gas station. And in fact, that's exactly what they hadn't wanted us to see. And so we went and were with this Arab family, found out everything that was going on. And people trusted him because they saw that he was also not playing on any tribal card. You know, he was looking for the truth.
Everything goes back to not being free.
Ayub Nouri never believed he could be a journalist in Iraq because the media weren't free. But he always knew how it could sound because it poured out of his father's radio.
He was listening to the Persian and Arabic service of the BBC when I was a child, every morning, every night. And then I bought my own radio and listened to the BBC all day long. And I think that's how I learned my English, from listening to the BBC. I was jealous of the reporters when they were reading their sign off saying so-and-so from Kuala Lumpur, for example. That was my only dream, one day to be a reporter and say that.
For the world, I am Ayub Nouri, Baghdad.
We're talking to Ayub Nouri, who reports for the BBC. He's been telling me
for the world, this is Ayub Nouri, Kut, southern Iraq.
Ayub is also in New York at the moment, studying at Columbia Journalism School. But like Ziad, like Ali, Ayub is planning to head back. As the death toll mounts and the despair deepens in Iraq, these and many other Iraqi journalists are ready to stand up, even as Western journalists are forced to stand down. We spoke to Ziad, Ali, and Ayub in the fall of 2006. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 177 journalists and support staff have died in the service of reporting this war. 154 of them were Iraqis.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Bolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Andy Lancet, Kevin Lahota, Nadia Zonis, and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On our site, onthemedia.org, you can find highlights of OTM's coverage of the war and a timeline of media milestones. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.